No movies, all letters.
Yes. Don't say we never gave you anything. It's a special midweek episode.
All about you.
Yes. Our all-male review. M-A-I-L.
Stop that, please. Get no, it. No.
Anyway, we are emptying out.
I want to start over.
We're emptying
just
out.
Just so we cannot do that, what you just did.
Shush. We're emptying out the letter bag and getting caught up on all of our correspondence from you, the listener, with your many questions and comments and
there's a lot of stuff. There are so many.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap and a film critic on What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
I'm very sweaty. That were a job, I'd be a billionaire at that right now.
You are Dave White, hiatal hernia, hiatus film critic for...
What are you talking about?
You're on hiatus from reviewing movies.
And yet I do not have a hiatal hernia.
You do not. For linoleum-knife.com, but you will be back reviewing films for them.
As soon as I'm done writing this dang book.
Yes.
Everything takes so very long.
I know.
Such a long time. You know, I thought recording the audiobook was going to take, like, no time, the finger-snapping amount of time.
Yeah.
It has taken a very long time.
It is, yeah.
I make a lot of mistakes. There are some days that have just been too dang hot to get in that tiny little closet and sweat my butt off.
You mean the recording studio?
That's, yes.
Also known as a closet with heavy bedspreads.
Blankets and stuff,
it,
yeah. So. Anyway. Let's get right into this.
Let's. What do we got?
This is from Patrick.
Okay.
Hello, David Alonzo. This is Patrick writing in again. Last time I wrote in was when I sent my extensive list of favorite films back in the spring. I hope your summer went well.
I am fine. How are you? Thank you, Patrick. We did have a great summer.
I fell a little behind on the podcast this summer and finally just caught up. You know, that's a lesson for everyone. Don't fall behind.
It's all the more catching up to do later.
Don't do that. Don't fall behind. Listen to every episode. Listen to every episode twice. Tell all your friends to listen to every episode. We have more listeners than we did when we first started.
It's true.
It's never enough.
That's also true.
We need to become infinitely more out into the world.
In 5 years, we're hitting our 5-year anniversary in November, and
yeah.
I like to think we have hit the level that is described in the movie of World According to Garp as a cult failure.
Below, I attached my list of my top 10 favorite first-time viewings of the summer.
All right.
In hopes that you would knife it. I watched a lot of fantastic cinema. This summer, this is a podcast of the cinema. It was especially difficult to narrow it down to 10 films with fall right around the corner. I figured it's time to branch out and dive into some of my blind spots. My two biggest areas for me that I'm not too familiar with are African cinema and silent film.
Wow.
I'm you know, there's not a lot for me on both of those counts either.
Okay, a little on silent, but kind of terrible on African.
I've seen most of the typical silents that pop up on all the large lists, but I haven't really fallen head over heels for that many. Really enjoyed a lot of Dreyer's silents, especially Michael from 1924.
Okay.
Do you have any obscure recommendations for either category?
Africa, I got nothing. I mean, I would say, like, you know, I know the name Ousmane Sembene.
Yeah, me too.
That's kind of a leading filmmaker. I will say this on obscurish silent films. I saw a We always think of Cecil B. DeMille as just making those big, giant, you know, epics, but he also made some kind of jazzy sort of morality tales. The Golden Bed, I caught that at CineFamily one night. That was really entertaining.
I'm super into The Godless Girl.
That's a good one, too.
The one about the atheist girl who...
Yes.
Who she rues the day
that
she tells everyone she was an atheist.
Well, the golden...
All kinds of bad things happen to her.
The Golden Bed has, like, a candy magnate who marries the wrong person, and things get terrible, and...
Am I buzzing? What's going
somebody,
on?
Yes, Dave White. Dave White's phone is buzzing. Dave White, who likes to scold me when my phone occasionally does something.
I've just moved it away so it's not buzzing on the table.
Thank you. So those are both, I think, both DeMille films. I would check those out for sure.
Okay, top 10 first-time viewings of the summer.
Okay.
All that Heaven Allows.
Good,
which
yeah.
Which is great. Truffaut's Bed and Board, which I've not seen.
That's one of the Antoine Doinel movies.
Okay. Good one. Truffaut's Stolen Kisses.
Also one of the Antoine Doinel movies.
The Red Shoes.
Come
on.
I'm going to give it to him, but I will say I'm one of the few people that I know that does not love that movie. It's gorgeous.
What's wrong with you?
I don't know. I'm not into it.
You're wrong.
I'm understanding that everybody in the world feels differently about that film than I do.
Magnificent Obsession.
Ooh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
More good Cirque.
Godard's Une Femme Mariée.
I have not seen that one.
Yeah, me neither.
He's the possession guy.
Yes.
But I don't know.
But I haven't seen that other. I haven't seen that other film. Eric Rohmer's The Green Ray.
Not my favorite Rohmer, but, you know.
It's Eric Rohmer.
Everything he does is worth seeing.
Bresson's L'Argent.
Oh, well, you got Dave in your corner now.
This is an incredible film. And The Mother and the Whore.
Which I still need to see.
Yeah, me too. I haven't seen Mother and the Whore.
It's like 3 hours or something.
Patrick, you have outseen us on
indeed.
Some of these.
Yeah. You are 100% knife.
And you are 100% knife because we're giving you the benefit of the doubt with the other stuff.
I like Beware of a Holy Whore, which is the
the
Fassbinder, like Fassbinder sort of, you know, anti day for night about how awful it is to make movies.
This is from Gareth.
Okay.
Subject line, I stand with Dave on American Ultra.
I have Whitney Seibold in my corner, so...
I don't care about him.
Bring it.
I don't care about no Whitney Seibold.
Well, what's this Gareth got to say that's so great?
Messy as it is, the emotional center was deeply affecting for me, too. The tender scenes were well written and wonderfully performed by the two leads, and the direction took a step up during the revelation of Stewart's... becoming both romantic and erotic. Yes, it is totally bonkers. It doesn't totally make sense. It has its flaws. But just like Adventureland, it was more than just what it was advertised and had a stirring core. I totally get why someone might detest it, though.
Well, I'm glad you do, because I do.
Gareth, you and I are brothers of being correct. This is from Bill. This is probably going to be long-winded, he writes. I saw American Ultra at 5:30 this afternoon, opening weekend Saturday, and there were about 9 other people in the theater. Ouch. I went into the movie knowing a good deal about it. That's my usual MO. Spoilers also don't affect my enjoyment of things. And I also read Alonzo's review on The Wrap the day before. This is the type of movie I like quite a bit, so I will always give them a chance, simply on premise. Because action movies push my buttons. I unironically love Tango and Cash, but only because of Kurt Russell. Yes, I have bad taste, but I don't care. 2 thumbs up for Crawl. I think the first half was great, and it shows that there was a lot of potential for this movie. Topher Grace was just right in the first half. Tony Hale had a good setup as well. I won't say I hated the end, but it was definitely weak. And I think it was due to wasted potential. They didn't do enough with Tony Hale. They didn't do enough with Topher Grace. And WTF Bill Pullman. The ending made me think it was reshot or rewritten after getting studio notes. After hearing your LK discussion, I was thinking about what movies are in the same vein as American Ultra, but are better. There's The Bourne Identity. Then there is the best movie of summer 2015, Spy. Basically, American Ultra is Dude, Where's My Bourne Identity? If that was the pitch that came into my office as a Hollywood producer, I would have loved the idea. The execution wasn't there, but I'd still give it a 6 out of 10. There's still room for something to make a funny... I didn't know... Plot, spoilers.
Look, at this point, anybody who's gonna see American Ultra...
You don't know that? You don't know.
Fine, whatever.
You don't know. That's from Bill in Vegas.
Thank you, Bill. That movie is dumb, and so is Dave White.
This is from Robbie. What is up, my linoleum knife brothers? I rush out to see American Ultra almost immediately after listening to your podcast. I wasn't even going to go, but I just had to see what the fuss was about. Truthfully, I came out pretty indifferent, liking it more than not, but I didn't see the movie either of y'all are seeing. I can see hints of the giddy inspiration that Dave did, mostly in the setup, but once it started becoming completely a CIA movie, I gradually lost interest. Before Alonso gets too excited, I don't really see the self-satisfied hip in quotation marks stuff. I can say the only thing in this movie I found annoying enough to be hateful was Topher Grace. Considering I sat through the garbage heaps that were Chappie and Pitch Perfect 2, both of which Mr. Duralde was alarmingly kind to.
I was not kind to Chappie.
American Ultra, at the very least, kept me mildly entertained. You sit there and be scolded. You'll have your chance to talk.
I will take the Pitch Perfect 2 bullet, but not Chappie.
I loved Adventureland because it was basically 2 hours of Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart hanging out and smoking weed, and I kind of wish American Ultra would have been some indirect sequel where they just hang out and smoke weed again. Secondly, on the discussion of American independent films stemming from y'all's grandma review, I agree with Dave to an extent that there is a lot of formal laziness in newer Sundance-ish indies. I hear Alonzo's argument that a good script and actors should be enough, and I love formally inept movies like Clerks. But I don't think Cassavetes falls into that category at all. Granted, of his directorial work, I've only seen A Woman Under the Influence and The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, but both of those films have a lot of visual qualities that I love that aid the films in ways that script or dialogue can't really illuminate. I don't necessarily have the technical jargon to explain why I feel that way, but his touch is far more cinematic than, say, Joe Swanberg.
Well, sure.
Anyway, thank you for reading this long-ass letter and for the hours of podcasting entertainment. Cheers, Robbie.
Well, thanks. And I don't mean to imply that Cassavetes is not a visually adept filmmaker. He does some interesting stuff.
Own your incorrection.
But, you know, I think, I mean, yes, in China, Killing the Chinese Bookie, absolutely. But if you look at something like Husbands or Minnie and Moskowitz or, you know, Opening Night, I think it's more of a piece with what you see in a lot of the sort of Sundance movies we're talking about, where he's more interested in the performances and not so much in you know, a visual aesthetic. But that's just me. I'm sure there are Cassavetti fanatics who would disagree.
This letter is from a person whose name I cannot pronounce. Spelled M-A-A-K-O.
Okay.
Mako? I don't know.
Just say M.
All right. Hey, guys. Big fan of the podcast. Thank for your work. Blah, blah, blah.
He wrote blah, blah, blah.
He or she, I don't know if this is a male or female name.
M wrote blah, blah,
blah. I don't even want to be that binary about it.
M.
After your pause the other week on the pronunciation of Alicia Vikander's name, I figured I'd help you out. Lightning round, Swedish name pronunciations for you. Alicia Vikander is Vikander.
Vikander.
Stellan Skarsgård. Skarsgård. Like a gourd. Mm. Yeah, Skarsgård. Anita Ekberg is actually pronounced apparently Ekberg.
Mm.
Yeah, like a E. Ekberg. I have never heard anyone say her name that way, but then again, I've only ever heard Americans say her name.
And butchering it.
And I'm an especially colloquial American. Without the international background of other people who host this podcast. Michael Nyqvist, who we've always called Michael Nyqvist. Apparently it's Nyqvist.
I say Nyqvist.
You say Nyqvist? Yeah. Dolph Lundgren is Lundgren. Lundgren.
Lundgren, okay. Of course, we just had this one listener to take this from. You know, they could just be messing.
Look, this person has a name I can't pronounce, so clearly this person knows better than we do.
And this person did not send a pronunciation guide for this person's own name.
We would like that. didn't mean this to correct you, just thought you might be interested, you know, being like down with Europe stuff and sounding smarter than other people.
Always. Vikander, okay.
Subject line, linoleum knife, bringing families together. This is from Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, kind sirs. This is a quick thank you to Dave for his... I always deserve thanks.
Yes, go on.
For his DVD pick of Once Upon a Time in the West, the giddy description of what a total horror show Henry Fonda's character is prompted me to buy a copy, only $5, and bring it along on my week-long trip to see my dad in western Wisconsin this past week. It was a perfect selection for dad and daughter movie night, though it turned out dad had seen it before 30 or so years ago. As promised, Henry Fonda's character was a giant creep. I am a little disappointed Dave didn't mention the most important part, aside from the amazing music and the rad storytelling and the beautifully composed shots of dudes in hats standing places. Jason Robards was foxy as heck as Cheyenne. You're right. He was. Sadly, my double feature follow-up of Rio Bravo was a letdown. It was either that or The Sons of Katie Elder from Dad's limited DVD collection. But I have only myself to blame for that. I know you have well-wishers, fans, and groupies who send you various foodstuffs. But I wasn't sure if squeaky fresh cheese curds would be of interest in your household. Oh, God.
Yes. Next time you go to Wisconsin...
Put that stuff on dry ice. Get it down here to Los Angeles.
We'll make poutine.
I mean, you know, if you want to.
Yes, we're not forcing anything. But we are pro-curd. Cheese curd.
If so, say the word, and I'll send the very best from my favorite cheese factory in the fall. Word.
Yeah, it's on.
Yeah. I hope to pester y'all closer to my scheduled trip to Los Angeles in January for Dave and Alonzo restaurant recommendations. Friends and I are coming to do comedy nerd things like go to UCB and, fingers crossed, the Paul F. Tompkins
Spontaneation, I think.
It's spelled in a... There's no T in this word. Mm. It's spelled Spontaneation. Spontaneation is how it is?
I think that's what it is.
It's at Largo.
Yeah.
Which is our neighborhood, pretty much. Yeah. Yay for you both, Jesse. P.S. I won't be able to ask your advice about which 2 to 3 titles out of this festival, click on the link to find out which festival this is, to make time for in the coming weekend. I'm pretty sure I'll be seeing House of Bamboo, if only for the promised sexually ambiguous Robert Ryan.
Well.
This is the Noir City Music... This is the Noir City Film Festival at the Music Box Theater in Chicago, which is happening right now as we record this, so...
I've never seen House of Bamboo. That's Sam Fuller, right?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
Robert Ryan, sexually ambiguous or otherwise, is definitely a draw.
This is from Mr. M.A. Ross.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be awesome to hear the hosts of Linoleum Knife interviewed on Matt Baume's The Sewers of Paris.
Lucky you.
Lucky you. That's already happened.
Yes.
And that episode is going to air sometime in September.
Correct.
We recorded it like 5 days ago.
Yeah.
With him.
Maybe one episode, maybe two episodes.
Yeah, so we're going to be on sometime in September.
Yeah, we'll obviously alert folks when that's happening.
He says it would be just as awesome to get Mr. Baume on the knife and maybe get a list or a DVD pick out of him, which is a great idea.
Hmm.
next time he's in town. He don't live here anymore.
Right, he's in Seattle.
Yeah.
In the meantime, however, do go check out the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, the Your Opinion Sucks panel that I did with Leonard Maltin and Paul Scheer from How Did This Get Made, recorded live at the UCB Theater in L.A., is posted and up and running, and it's fun. I had a good time doing it.
This is from Chris, whose last name is the same as mine, only spelled with a Y.
Okay.
Dear chaps, having recently discovered your podcast and subsequently attempting to devour as many archived editions as I can manage, I am writing to say thank you. It is a rare thing to find an hour of media as entertaining, funny, and informative as yours.
Aw, thank you.
I love it. It makes rainy days and Mondays here in England bearable again. I have nothing to say about films on this occasion.
Well, rainy days and Mondays
are my favorite things.
Mondays?
Mondays are fine. I got no beef with Monday.
All right, fine, Garfield.
I'm fine with Monday. No, Garfield hates Mondays.
I know, it was a joke.
Yeah. Yeah, Monday, boy, do I love it when it rains.
Mondays is when we get the farmer's market.
You barely get any. Well, yeah, that's a nice day. Yeah. Okay, here's letter number one from Noah.
All right.
All right, squad. This is how you can tell Noah is young, because he uses young person slang, such as squad. If you're over the age of 30 and you are using the word squad, you need to think about your life.
Also on this fleek. Is
young person's words, you know. Just say, my friends.
Yeah.
But it's okay for Noah.
He's a youngster.
He's young.
Is on fleek, is that over or is it still around?
We don't discuss on fleek
house. We're talking about verboten words for people over 30. That's the only reason I'm bringing it up.
That's a stupid word.
It is.
It's a stupid word that no one should use.
I'm not saying otherwise. If I could retire one, it would be, yeah.
I'm okay with that one. Mm. I'm especially okay with it when Ilana says it on Broad City.
Well, it was charming for a while. I'm kind of sick of it now.
When I was physically relieving pain in my back area yesterday evening, I came across Dave's food recipe on the Facebook. I'm not going to explain to you what that is if you don't know. It's Facebook. He calls it the Book of Face. That's what I just said Facebook.
Gotcha.
Because I did know what that was.
Mm.
Anyhow, at the moment I saw that, I was inspired to do some cooking myself. Let me tell you, when I cook, I cook. The dish I made was honey mustard sauteed chicken topped with parsley, along with a side dish of garlic knots and greens. Now here's a question relating to film. What films have you seen that have made you the most hungry? There was a time when I was watching Jon Favreau's Chef in the evening time without eating anything at all. Throughout the day, it felt as if I was going to die. But I didn't. I'm sure you see that because you're reading this letter that I wrote while giving my dog belly rubs and belly kisses. Until the next letter, my beautiful, light-skinned, facial-haired gay comrades. Noah, 15, black, residing in Long Beach, California.
That's a lot of things. Movies that made me hungry.
Chef did it for me. I mean, like, the closing credits, when Roy Choi is making the grilled cheese, and he's slathering the outside with butter, just to make it butterier and crispier. There's a sandwich shop directly across the street from where I saw the movie. And I went over there, and I ordered their grilled cheese, just because I needed a grilled cheese so badly. When I was done, Big Night makes me hungry.
Big Night, yeah. Babbitt's Feast.
Babbitt's Feast. Tampopo makes me hungry.
Tampopo, totally.
I want that ramen real bad after Tampopo.
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I really want candy.
You know, all films make me hungry.
I'm trying to think like where the, just where the cooking is just really
eating Raul. Hostel.
I want the kitchen from It's Complicated, but
Man,
that does make me hungry though.
That kitchen.
Cooking movies.
I do not want to eat whatever Jean Dielman was cooking.
No, those potatoes. Did not look
that's just the saddest food.
Mm. I'm thinking about fried chicken. Oh,
Tapeheads.
301, 302.
Oh yes, yes, yes. It's a Korean film from the 90s called 301, 302.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about the food. It's about situation.
Well, it's about these two women who are neighbors, and one is terrified of food and avoids it, and the other one is obsessed with it and is constantly cooking. And
Julie and Julia, even though it wasn't a good film necessarily,
it
made me want to eat all that stuff.
Yeah, that bœuf bourguignon.
Yeah.
You know, oddly enough, actually out on DVD this week is Gemma Bovary, and a lot of that movie is set in a French bakery.
Yeah.
And that all looks very delicious.
Oh, well, I'll... Oh, you know what? Marie Antoinette.
Oh, right. Yeah, that kicked off your whole obsession with macaron.
That kicked off my macaron obsession, yeah. Which has continued to this day. I was not trendy with the macaron. They're my boyfriend for life.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know my place.
This is another one from Mr. M.A. Ross.
Okay.
Someone had asked about movies that go from bad to good. There was only one that came to my mind. Barton Fink.
Huh.
I tell people it's a roller coaster style movie where the beginning is slow and arduous, but once it gets to its peak, it takes off on its twists and turns.
See, I'm such a nerd for old Hollywood stuff that I think I like the beginning better. I like all the, you know, it's a wrestling picture. Wallace Beery. What else do you need to know? And the stuff with Judy Davis and John, you know, the dad from Frasier. What's that guy's name? I'm blanking.
I don't remember his name.
Anyway, that guy.
Yeah.
Basically playing, what, F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald? I don't know who they were supposed to be. Or he's Faulkner and she's somebody. I don't know.
This is from Gordon. Alonzo and Dave. I want to build tangentially on Ryan's email from last week. This is the 9th of August, 2015. Okay. About the Marvel movies.
Ah.
Being a massive nerd, and also being too young to realize my own awfulness when I perpetuate this Marvel nonsense. I was contemplating the wider implications of the MCU this morning, the Marvel Comics.
Cinematic Universe.
The Marvel Cinematic Universe. And decided to re-listen to your LK review of The Winter Soldier. During that review, Alonso mentioned that he didn't particularly like the first Cap movie, and that he never really connected with Chris Evans' portrayal of Steve Rogers. For some reason, I can't find a Linoleum Knife review of the first Avenger, so I'll presume that he, in his own wisdom, had his reasons.
Were we... What year was that movie? Were we on the air yet?
I thought we were.
Well, we've been doing the show since 2010. I think... Oh, you know, I don't remember why we didn't review Captain America. I remember having to see that movie before we went to Maine in the summer of 2011.
That was 2011, so we would have done it.
Yeah, I guess it might have. We just didn't pre-tape a show or whatever, so we never talked about
it. We might have skipped a week or something.
Could be.
Back before you became such a whip-cracking...
Well, we had less of an audience then. Now we have more of one. You can, if you go to The Wrap, I did review it in print, so you can find that.
You obviously didn't see the same things in the movie that I did, so I thought I would email you guys and fly some of my theories by you as to why TFA is a good movie. I love the Captain America movies, both of them, so far. Yeah, just for the record.
No, look, like with the red shoes, most people really like that first Captain America, and I think there are moments of it that really are effective, that Joe Johnson brings that sort of rocketeer, rah-rah 40s stuff to it. But I also feel like there are moments of the movie where I can tell that you're supposed to be moved now, or you're supposed to be this now, and it was not landing for me.
This particular notion has been very popular among diehard fans, particularly those of the high-pitched female variety. I don't know what he means by that.
Go on.
What do you make of the suggestion that Steve Rogers, as portrayed by Chris Evans, is bisexual?
Hadn't occurred to me.
That thought had never occurred to me.
What do you got?
Obviously, making Captain America openly LGBT would cause massive controversy.
Yeah.
It would be far too risky for the ever-skittish Kevin Feige to allow, but fans have founded this theory on the following inferences. Number one, the neighborhood that Steve and Bucky live in at the start of TFA was widely reputed to be the gay neighborhood in 1940s Brooklyn.
Okay.
Number two, that went right by me.
Yeah.
Number two, the start of the movie is built around the idea of Steve wanting to join the army but cannot because of who he is. This being a reference to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was still in effect when this movie was released.
Yeah, here's the thing, though. When we're at war, they are very happy to look the other way.
Do. Yeah, they sure do.
And then they start court-martialing.
Or did, anyway.
Yeah, then they start court-martialing all the gays as soon as we were back in peacetime.
Number three, various lines of dialogue between the characters, most especially Bucky to Steve. You're still keeping the outfit, right? Four, comments made by the actors, most especially Haley Atwell, who said on Twitter that if Steve didn't end up with Peggy, she would prefer he end up with Bucky over Black Widow or Sharon. Fans have reported hearing Samuel Jackson and other MCU actors make allusions of Captain America not being straight. But all of this is far from confirmable and conclusive. Which, of course, has not stopped a clique of particularly militant fans swearing black, red, white, and blue that Steve Rogers is as bisexual as Fantastic Four is insufferable. While I personally am not 100% convinced, this suggestion has nevertheless made me feel more invested in the Steve-Bucky relationship and the Cap movies overall than I otherwise would have been, Chris Evans's everything aside. Obviously, no direct evidence in either regard will ever come to be. Marvel seems to be treating its non-white, straight male movies as the cinematic equivalent of a root canal and would never, ever steer one of its main moneymakers into what it views as choppy waters, which essentially renders the matter and this email entirely pointless. On that note, I bid you adieu to get on with more important things, e.g. your fantastic podcast, which makes my Monday mornings just that little bit brighter. Keep up the good work, Gordon.
Well, thank you, Gordon. Food for thought, for sure. And I will say the Cap-Bucky relationship is obviously the strongest through line, you know, for the films. And, it you know, we've already gotten hints that it's going to matter in the next round of movies. You know, I would say this, that anybody who's trying to say that they aren't can fall back on the old, you know, my buddy thing.
Explain what you're talking
about. Yeah, the song My Buddy was very popular during World War II, right?
I don't know.
I believe it's World War II. Basically, the notion that male friendships, because homosexuality wasn't discussed in the mainstream and wasn't was considered such a taboo factor in society at large, that you were allowed to have these intimate male friendships on a more innocent plane because nobody looked at them and thought, you know. And so that comradeship between men is sort of idolized in a lot of art like that. The song, if you go back and watch the first Academy Award winning Best Picture, Wings, from 1927, you see these pilots from the Air Force.
World War One.
Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
I just looked that up.
Very affectionate with each other and very like huggy and touchy. And because homosexuality is sort of removed from the discussion, it's thought to be something else. It's thought to be this, you know, like I said, this level of comradeship. So I'm sure that people could point to the 1940s and say, oh, well, they were just, you know, they were best friends and da-da-da. But at the same time, I think there's a postmodern way to look at those relationships and say, well, no, there's more going on there, you know, in the same way that we can now reinterpret characters from literature and mythology like Damon and Pythias or, you know, David and Jonathan or whatever as being kind of these proto-gay / crypto-gay relationships that were just always sort of understood to be close male friendships.
Everything is gay. Everything.
Because we say so.
This is from James. I can't urge you enough to embrace the world of multi-region DVD and Blu-ray. You can get Boom, Tideland, and Nowhere on DVD in the UK, for example. And there are doubtless more titles available on mainland Europe. And for all the ones we get here in the UK that you don't get in the US, we miss out on loads of titles here, so it works both ways. It especially irks me that I have to buy loads of Mike Lee Blu-rays from the US when he is a British filmmaker. I got multi-region DVD Blu-ray a few years back and haven't looked back since. Any film fans should really do likewise. Otherwise, you're just denying yourself a world of pleasure.
You are right. Why
can't you just get ours hacked? Who can hack our player and make it happen?
Well, it used
Don't we have enough nerd friends out there in order to do this thing?
It used to be that you could buy a cheap DVD player and very easily hack it, and that's gotten harder over the years. And, of course, now there's the whole issue of Blu-ray as well. So either we need to spring for a multi-region Blu-ray player or find one that's hackable, or I don't know. We'll talk to our techie friends and see what we can find out.
Speaking of techie friends, here's a letter from Dave.
Ah.
Dave K.
Yes.
Yeah. Here's my 2 cents. My guess as to why the 90s movies in Christian Marclay's The Clock would pop is because they were probably transferred to video right after their release and not retransferred. I don't know what that means. Much of the same way movies from about 1979 to 1981 had a very particular smeary video look to their first VHS transfers, because the telescenes of that time used tube cameras instead of CCDs. I can't understand anything he's talking about.
Just carry on. I have a vague notion.
Instead of CCDs resulting in noticeable video lag, the advent of DVD had every studio remastering their libraries, but this was in a pocket of time when the video transfer technology had that particular compressed look to them. So until the movies were again remastered for Blu-ray with better telecine. I've never known how to say that word. Until today.
Yeah.
Technology, they have that digital color compressed look to them. That's my guess, anyway. Well, your guess is more complicated than anything I could ever understand.
Well, let's back up and explain what we're talking about here.
I don't know what we're talking about anymore.
When I went to see the rest of Christian Marclay's The Clock, I noticed that the movies of the 90s really stood out visually in this weird sort of kind of smoky way. And I was trying to figure out why that was. And what Kittredge is saying is it's not that the movies made during that time were shot significantly differently from other decades, but that the video transfers aren't as crisp because they haven't been remastered for digital. So they look like old VHS and kind of cruddy. So basically it's about what Markley was working with, not about the movies themselves.
I see.
Thank you, Dave. Even though that was a little baffling, I mostly get what you're talking about.
I never understand anything he's talking about. You know, he's my friend and all, but I never understand what he's talking about. There's almost never, when we're talking about technical things about films,
mm-hmm.
he's
next level.
He's in someone's control room with knobs that I don't know the function of.
No, he is a working filmmaker and editor. Yeah. He understands how this stuff works way better than we ever will.
This is from Bjorn. Seeing the trailer of Stonewall makes me wonder if it's going to be worth seeing, because it removes actual minorities, trans women, and women from the film. How am I to view these historical films when the context has changed? Is a film like this even worthy of my effort to support? I choose not to see the Alan Turing movie based on your review, stating how much had been changed from reality. I'm trying to figure out how to view my history within the context of films if the films aren't even trying to be close to correct.
I think that the movies have been egregious in this department. Not just about the gay stuff. I mean, generally speaking, if you're getting your history from movies, you are probably not getting the real thing.
No, correct. Yeah.
As far as Stonewall goes, I'm reserving judgment until I see the actual movie, because, as I was telling somebody, the trailer is there to sell this movie to a mass audience, not just to gay people who know what the story is, but mainly probably to straight people who don't know what the story is, because they want this to be a crossover film.
Yes.
So my thinking is that even if the film of Stonewall were wall-to-wall trans people of color throwing bricks at the NYPD,
yes,
you would still have a trailer that focused on the photogenic white guy
right.
in the movie.
Yes.
Now, if it turns out that the movie itself also focuses on the photogenic yes. white guy, then yes, I will call shenanigans. But I'm going to wait until I see the movie.
Me too.
They put out a second poster that does feature
that
more
shows
people
everybody.
Of color.
Yeah.
So if you've got John Robin Bates and you know Roland Emmerich sort of saying, "Hey, look, everybody, calm down. Wait till you see the movie." I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt until I see the movie, at which case all bets are off.
Yes. This is from Reed, very good friend of the show, Reed
yes.
Martin,
author of The Real Truth: Everything You Didn't Know You Needed to Know About Directing an Independent Film, Making an Independent
Something
Film.
Like
Something
that.
Something like that. He didn't pay for this one. So
we're not
we
doing,
get the title
we're not doing
wrong,
ads, so we've forgotten the title. Chris Farley.
Oh, yes, right.
Farley told Esquire, or GQ, in an interview close to the end, that he idolized Belushi and always felt he had to outdo John Belushi in every respect, on all fronts. To keep up.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. That's the whole letter. That's the whole email.
Okay.
That's, yeah.
We were talking about the I Am Chris Farley
documentary. There's a reason, I guess, right there. Yeah.
And Joel Ryan had seen it and we were discussing that it didn't really get deep into why he was such a creature of excess. So that's Reed's theory.
Letter 2 from Noah.
All right.
Hello, and I'm sorry. I know in my first letter I stated that I will only be sending you one. This just so happens to not be the case in these peaceful circumstances the three of us take part in. But here is the reason I have written you again. On Friday, July 31st, 2015, I saw Mission Impossible: Rogue Nation. I loved it. A lot. But there was something that kept me from enjoying the experience of that movie. This rude white man, he continued to shout out every single event of significance in the film to his Asian female friend. Now, to add a cherry on top of that cake, he took his shoe off and began rubbing his toes.
Ew.
That would have been fine if he had nice feet, but he did not. They were ugly. Not only that, they stunk. That's just something you don't do. Save that for whoever has to deal with you and your disgusting feet. It was shocking to me too, sirs, because I was the only one in my row. The theater was packed, so he comes all the way to the middle and sits right next to me.
Ugh.
I do not understand people, and I can only imagine how my beautiful gay light-skinned gay friends who are film critics would have felt. Here's how I would have felt. Equally disgusted.
Mm.
I would have gotten up and walked very far away.
Well, you would have shushed him. Once he started with the...
Oh, yeah, I would have shushed him first.
With
yeah.
the plot synopsis.
But the foot stuff is beyond the...
Yeah, that's... You just
you
get
You can't
away.
Shush someone's feet. You gotta move. You gotta go.
Yeah, yeah, that's your cue to exit.
The dude clipping his fingernails. Remember the dude clipping his fingernails?
I will never forget the guy clipping his fingernails.
In Legend of Drunken
yes.
Master. Ugh, just the worst people.
Ugh.
Worst people alive.
Ugh.
You foot and fingernail clipper people. Hang on.
Okay.
Here's another one from Reed Martin about the way 90s movies look.
Oh, okay. Maybe this one will be more comprehensible for you.
It could be the confluence of the film grammar of Tony Scott and John McTiernan reaching full bloom with their overuse of lens flares as a visual signature pre-J.J. Abrams, combined with a total lack of film grain in the newer film stocks, as the look of Aliens fell out of favor. Also, it could be timed with the U.S. arrival of Darius Kondji and his preference for bleach bypass, as seen in films like Seven, and or finally affordable digital intermediate color correction. It could be a little bit of all of these, but most likely it's just as simple as the film stock that came into favor at that time, or previous stocks with grain that went away to break with the 80s.
Huh.
That does make more sense to me.
All right.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have Reed and Dave on so they can fight it out. That would be great podcast.
Like in person?
Yes.
Like an in-person fight?
Yes.
Yeah. someone wants to buy it.
The jargon will fly thick.
Dear sirs, this is from Peter. Please send me details on how to purchase one of your fine t-shirts and have it sent to the UK.
We're between t-shirts,
exactly. but I just placed an order.
Oh, great.
So, yeah.
Okay.
On a slightly different note, it turns out that I have met the mighty Dave White.
Really?
Before he was Dave White. Look, man, I've always been Dave White.
Back when you were Archie Leach.
Before he was Dave White, we know and bow before today. I say met, it was more like he stood next to John Peel at a gig. At this very gig, a very sweaty me dived towards Mr. Peel and embraced him. I believe you mentioned this gig in a previous podcast during your time in London, according to my friend who has been working. He's working his way through them. I must confess the gig in most of the late 80s to mid 90s is a bit of a blur, but I've been assured I had a good time. Really enjoying the show and would like to show my support for the pair of you. Cheers, Pete.
Thank you, Pete.
That was the Mud Honey show.
Right.
1989. Mud Honey with opening band Soundgarden. Mud Honey were more popular and well-known at the time. They came to London. They performed at the London School of African Studies in a very small theater at the University of London.
And at no extra price, a riot broke out.
It is in the Mudhoney documentary. It is the one and only time I have ever been at a show that became known as legendary.
Hmm.
And Mr. Peel was in the back with me, avoiding
this guy.
The riot. Yeah.
And his sweaty hugs.
I did have a dude come up to me, though, at that show and talk to me about the t-shirt I was wearing. I was wearing a Sonic Youth t-shirt that had been available during their Evil tour. And he was like, "Where did you get that shirt?" And I said, "I'm American."
We get everything.
I'm from America, where we get the American Sonic Youth t-shirts.
Yeah.
The end of that story. Pause, please. Okay. Let me make sure I've got all of these.
So that brings us to the end of the mailbag. We thank everybody for writing in and encourage you to do so as well. Our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you with your top 10 lists, with your comments and queries and whatever else. I will be in Venice watching movies and eating things. So this weekend we'll have our regularly scheduled episode featuring Dave and our friend William Bibbs Bibiani from the B-Movies podcast.
Yep.
And Crave Online, and he does the What the Flick recaps with me. And then next week it'll either be me from Venice with someone or a slightly late episode in which Dave and I tape one when I get back.
Yes.
So in the meantime, do check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com, the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, where, again, I'm on their latest episode. Malton on Movies, The Canon. Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, The Film Spotting SVU, Game Night Guys, Secretly Timid, The Joel Ryan Thing, Sewers of Paris, The Brett Easton Ellis Podcast, and of course visit Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia, to find more music from Blue, who composed our wonderful theme music. Subscribe to the show for free at iTunes. Leave us a nice review there. It does help people find the show. Stream us at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com or on our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast, which you should totally go like if you haven't already. You can also join the Linoleum Knife group page on Facebook and talk about movies with other fans of the show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, where we've been posting some of our older episodes. Follow us on Twitter.
Didn't you just do that yesterday?
Yeah.
Didn't you post a new one?
I just posted a new one.
A new old one.
A very old one
from, yes, what, 2011?
2011.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about the Arthur remake and Soul Surfer.
Soul Surfer is so great.
Yeah, your description of it is pretty funny. I've still never seen it. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And if you are dying for more content, you can always buy our special Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes. They're $1.99 a piece. PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. They are feature-length DVD commentaries that you can listen to while you're watching the movie, or just listen to the way you normally listen to the show. The titles that we cover include The Poseidon Adventure, What's Up Doc, Clue, Josie and the Pussycats, Two for the Road, The Apple, and of course our holiday specials, White Christmas and Santa Claus. We have a couple coming up before the end of the year. We're going to be doing Gentlemen Prefer Blondes in September. We have another one, ideally, that we will be doing in the fall. And then, of course, another Christmas one in December. For the Christmas one, do we want to maybe, like, give them some choices and let people vote?
Or... no.
Okay, fine. Just a you don't get to pick. We'll tell you what we're doing for Christmas. Dave White has spoken. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.